And now the North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week, and read today by John Federson. This issue is dated May the 15th of 2025. And it's intended, of course, for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. Well, we have the usual mix of political, administrative, i.e. governmental articles, and some culture, arts, and perhaps a few food-related articles, which I love because I record this show at about 1 p.m. First, Raleigh City Council has ousted two planning commissioners. That's an all-volunteer body that makes recommendations to the City Council about zoning, development, and growth. Has two new members, and it lost two members who were eligible for reappointment and wanted to continue serving. It happened quickly. During the City Council's Tuesday meeting, the Deputy City Clerk told the council members that freshman planning commissioners Reeves Peeler and LaTanta McCrimmon were each seeking reappointment for a second term, and that Mayor Janet Cowell had nominated Mark Shelburne and Nick Neptune to replace them. Councilmember Jane Harrison made a motion to reappoint Peeler, a community organizer who works in affordable housing tax credit financing. Councilmember Christina Jones seconded it. The members voted by a show of hands. Harrison, Jones, and Megan Patton were ayes, and the other five, Cowell, Stormy Forte, Jonathan Lambert Melton, Mitchell Silver, and Corey Branch were nays, and the motion failed. Cowell then moved to appoint Mark Shelburne, a housing policy consultant with a background in law and planning. The motion passed with only Harrison and Jones voting in opposition. Cowell made a second motion to appoint Nick Neptune, her former colleague at Dix Park Conservancy and the outgoing chair of the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission, and this time the vote was unanimously in favor. It was all over in 90 seconds and without any discussion. Shelburne and Neptune are in, and Peeler and McCrimmon are out. At least they will be when their terms officially end in June. It didn't come as a huge surprise that the City Council chose not to reappoint McCrimmon, a lobbyist and political strategist, for a second term. Of the Planning Commission's 36 meetings over the last 2 years, she was only present for 18. When city staff asked her to explain her absence, she cited work conflicts. Earlier in the meeting, Stormy Forte nominated her to the Centennial Authority, which oversees Lenovo Center. Now, McCrimmon and Forte did not respond to Indy's request for comment. The reason for Peeler's removal are less clear. He showed up to meetings, 29 out of 36, which historically has been the main condition for reappointment. Indy looked back at years of Planning Commission rosters and found that it's rare for the City Council to remove a sitting commissioner. Before this week, only two other commissioners had been removed since 2017. That's the first year the rosters are publicly available. Another 17 either served until they hit the three-term limit, resigned, or didn't seek reappointment. Peeler tells the Indy he can't speculate about why the council voted to remove him because none of them communicated with him about it, either before or after the vote, saying, "Never at any point in the last 2 years have I gotten any outreach from any of them about what I do on the commission. I think I'm doing the correct thing. I'm following the comprehensive plan. I'm pushing for things that Raleigh needs, and I've never gotten negative feedback." He says that earlier this spring, as the end of his term approached, he reached out to all eight council members to let them know he was seeking reappointment, but initially heard back only from Harrison, Jones, and Patton, who said they would vote for him. Then on the eve of the vote, Cowell emailed to let him know she'd be nominating Shelburne. Cowell wrote, "I've worked with Shelburne since I was state treasurer and would really like to have his expertise on the Planning Commission and the connections he brings as an adjunct at UNC Chapel Hill." The email was to Peeler, and Indy viewed that. Lambert Melton also emailed Peeler that night. "Just a heads up," she wrote. "With Mary Black no longer on the council, I'm not sure if you're going to have 5 votes after the mayor's nomination." Black, a former council member, nominated Peeler to that commission in 2023. He was appointed with votes from Black, Forte, Harrison, Jones, Lambert, Melton, and Patton. Branch, and then Mayor Marianne Baldwin voted for a different nominee. Silver has since replaced Black as the council member for District A. On a commission made up mostly of architects and planners, Peeler's background in organizing and affordable housing underwriting was unique. Last year, he ran for city council, promising to create more affordable housing in Raleigh, expand protections for renters, and invest in bike and pedestrian infrastructure and public transit. He placed fourth in a field of 7 at-large candidates. As a planning commissioner, he tended to vote in favor of rezoning cases that followed the comprehensive plan, the city's blueprint for future growth and density. He tended to oppose projects that increased the city's outward sprawl or, in his view, didn't do enough to promote affordability and transit-oriented development. Peeler says, "I always harped on the city improving, but also developers coming forward voluntarily with inclusionary options because that's how we should be growing as a city. We shouldn't be excluding people. We shouldn't be segregating people by wealth and income. We hear them talk all the time at the council table about the need to get rid of exclusionary zoning and the need for more inclusive neighborhoods. So I would like to know why they don't want to actually do it in practice." Peeler was sometimes in the minority among his commission colleagues, but he only remembers one instance where he cast a deciding vote last September, when the commission voted 5-4 not to authorize the closure of one block of South Street to make room for a relocation of Red Hat Amphitheater. "I stand by that fully," he says. "Closing South Street was and is a horrible idea. City grids in downtown should not be closed off for any reason, and there were plenty of other architectural options for an amphitheater down there that didn't close the street." Even then, the commission's non-binding advisory vote didn't really matter. The council had already voted in favor of the closure. As for Shelburne and Neptune, they both say they are excited to get to work. Shelburne tells Indy he'll focus on, quote, "allowing housing to get built." In his application, he wrote, "Failure to do so will accelerate the affordability crisis, exacerbate displacement, and worsen homelessness." Neptune told Indy via email that he's interested in, quote, "thoughtfully guiding the growth, development, and preservation of our city so that every resident and neighborhood enjoys a balanced mix of housing affordability, parks and green spaces to play in, business districts to gather and work in, and a multitude of active and public transportation options, all while being particularly mindful of our legacy and long-term residents, and the stitching and fabric of our neighborhoods that are culturally rich, yet historically underserved." Lambert, Melton, and Silver told Indy their votes on Tuesday had everything to do with Neptune's and Shelburne's qualifications and nothing to do with Peeler and McCrimmon. Lambert, Melton wrote in a text to the Indy, "Mark Shelburne is widely regarded as an expert in the area of affordable housing development, specifically low-income housing tax credit projects. Nick Neptune has a great deal of knowledge about how to provide safe, accessible, multimodal options throughout the city, and that's a critical focus for new developments. I felt both of these applicants brought much-needed skills to the current board." Silver says this personnel shakeup is part of a bigger conversation the city council is having about how its boards and commissions should function. Although commissioners have come to expect they'll be reappointed until they hit a term limit, that may not be the case going forward, he says. Silver said, "This council wants to start to look very carefully at who gets nominated and how they get nominated." Cowell, Branch, and Forte, who also voted not to reappoint Peeler, didn't respond to requests for comment. Harrison, Patton, and Jones, who supported, told Indy they appreciated his unique perspective. Harrison wrote, "On rezoning cases, he often presents opportunities for improvement with regard to affordable housing, environmental protection, and the quality of life for Raleigh residents." Jones said there was, quote, "no pre-discussion among the members ahead of Tuesday's vote, but she suspects the council majority's pro-growth, pro-density vision for Raleigh, which sometimes aligns them with the powerful developer interests Peeler has criticized, played a role." And she said, "There's a big development influence in the city. My gut would say that might be an issue. I can't say that with certainty, and I think that's the point. The point is for no one to know, so that nothing could be held against anyone." And Jones adds, "I think the public thinks that we, the council, have these conversations and we all tell each other everything, and we don't. It feels like a trophy issue of putting people in places to get what one wants. It's messy. It's not my favorite thing about the job." And also from Raleigh area, now the awake prosecutor has been accused of withholding evidence again. For the second time in a year, a judge ruled a Wake County prosecutor improperly withheld potentially exonerating evidence from a defendant. He has also faced similar accusations in a third previous case. In the most recent case, Wake Superior Court Judge Paul Ridgway declared a mistrial. His April 11th order stated prosecutor Robert Stewart's, quote, "failure to turn over the exculpatory information hindered the ability of the defense to accurately represent her client." The defendant in the case is Sherrie Green, a 39-year-old Raleigh man who had been facing numerous drug trafficking and drug possession charges, including trafficking in heroin and fentanyl. Raleigh police officers initially arrested him in 2020 after a confidential informant allegedly bought illegal drugs from him three different times. Officers then executed a search warrant at the hotel room where he was staying. Normally, prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys exchange information and evidence in a process called discovery. Prosecutors are legally required to turn over any evidence that could be exculpatory or favorable to the defense. But Stewart did not turn over incriminating evidence pertaining to that confidential informant until after Green's trial started on March the 17th. The informant was a crucial witness for the prosecution, and Ridgway concluded that Green's attorney could have used that evidence to impeach the informant's credibility as a witness. Ridgway, however, did not find any evidence of misconduct on Stewart's part or that he intentionally tried to cause a mistrial. Green had been in the Wake County Jail since February of 2020 awaiting trial. Now that Ridgway has declared a mistrial, it will likely be months before prosecutors can retry the case. After the trial, Wake Superior Court's Judge A. Graham Shirley granted a motion that Green's attorney, Jackie Willingham, filed to get him released from jail. And the judge released him on electronic house arrest, and his trial is now scheduled to start September 15. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman has not taken any disciplinary action against Stewart. Stewart, who has been a prosecutor for about 3 years, did not return an email message or a phone call seeking comment. Freeman said in an interview that after an internal review, she found no evidence that Stewart committed any malfeasance or that he intentionally violated anyone's constitutional rights. Over the past several months, Freeman said she has instituted changes in how the office runs, particularly in the drug unit in which Stewart works, that will prevent further issues. Freeman said, "This is information that should have been disclosed. Our duty is to review why it happened and make sure it doesn't happen again." But Willingham, the attorney for the defense, is bothered that it happened at all. She said, since it is a pending case, there's not much I can say, except it is disappointing the DA's office is aware of the issue and continues to take no action to safeguard the rights of people charged. Ridgway had ordered Stewart and Willingham to provide full discovery 15 days before that March 17th trial, so no later than March 2nd. Stewart didn't make the deadline, Ridgway wrote in his order. After March 2nd, Stewart did provide Willingham with several documents about the confidential informant he intended to call as a witness during the trial, but it was incomplete, according to a transcript of a March 24 hearing. Willingham was asking Judge Shirley to release Green from jail, particularly because of the mistrial. The documents included the name of the woman who served as a confidential informant, that she had previously been charged with 2 counts of drug trafficking, that she had cooperated with Raleigh police on Green's case, and that she was listed as a victim in a separate human trafficking case, said Willingham. One paragraph mentions statements the informant made in an affidavit that police said a co-defendant might have coerced her into making, and that her charges were dismissed due to her cooperation. Willingham said at the hearing, "That is all that was provided to me the Wednesday before trial, so I had to spend the majority of Thursday and Friday trying to figure out what all of that was about. And I finally got reports from the trafficking and human trafficking case, both of which included exculpatory information regarding impeachment material for their material witness from the DA's office, from right down the hall from Mr. Stewart." In the course of that quick research, Willingham discovered the co-defendant had been accused of trafficking the confidential informant. Raleigh police detectives concluded the co-defendant had coerced her into making statements taking responsibility for the drugs, but Willingham didn't find out about the jail calls again until after the informant took the stand and testified that she had not had any contact with the co-defendant. Willingham asked Ridgway to order Stewart to turn over the jail calls. After listening to the calls, Ridgway granted Willingham's request. The calls not only proved the confidential informant lied about not having any contact with the co-defendant, but they also showed the woman actively talking about being willing to do whatever she needed to do to get the co-defendant out of jail. That called into question whether her false statements to police were coerced. Willingham said in the March 24th hearing this was clearly exculpatory evidence that Stewart should have provided her before the trial started and not after. The day after she received the jail calls, she asked Ridgway to declare a mistrial, which the judge granted. He wrote in his order that Stewart's late disclosure, quote, did not allow the defense to adequately prepare for the cross-examination of a significant witness against the defendant. This had the potential, quote, to cause irreparable damage to the defendant's case. Stewart was first publicly accused of withholding evidence in the case of Alden Rasmussen in 2024, when his attorney filed a motion to dismiss. Holly Springs police arrested Rasmussen and a co-defendant, whose name was redacted in court documents on June 16, 2023. Those officers seized 7 grams of fentanyl and 9 grams of methamphetamine. The two men were later indicted on drug trafficking charges, but Rasmussen said his co-defendant was only selling him drugs for personal use. Rasmussen's attorney, William Finn Jr., alleged in the motion that Stewart repeatedly failed to turn over evidence favorable to his client, such as the co-defendant's statements to authorities, and implied he would take away a plea deal for Rasmussen if his attorney persisted in making discovery requests. In November 2024, Shirley sanctions Stewart for the discovery violations, dismissing a habitual felon charge against Rasmussen. Shirley's court order prohibited Stewart from pursuing the charge again. On another case, criminal defense attorney Molly O'Neill filed a motion to dismiss on behalf of her client, Oswald Moore, in February. Raleigh police had arrested Moore in December of 2022, and he was later indicted for carrying a concealed gun, trafficking opioids, and other drug charges. As in Rasmussen's case, O'Neill alleged Stewart failed to turn over certain evidence, including messages from cell phones and statements Moore's co-defendant made to both law enforcement and the prosecutor. Moore spent previously more than 2 years in prison awaiting trial for murder in a case O'Neill said was riddled with errors. He was acquitted at that trial in 2021. O'Neill also said Stewart revoked a plea officer to Moore, a plea offer to Moore without providing the requested information. Stewart did eventually turn over a heavily redacted copy of those statements, and after a June 2024 hearing, Superior Court Judge G. Brian Collins ordered Stewart to provide an unredacted copy. Collins also reduced Moore's bond from $400,000 to $20,000, which allowed him to get out of jail. Stewart gave O'Neill a, quote, less redacted copy of the statements. According to the motion, the redacted portion included the co-defendant saying he had bought the fentanyl seized in Moore's arrest. The co-defendant was again interviewed in 2024, but O'Neill said she didn't receive the officer's report until 7 months later. A judge has not ruled on O'Neill's motion. Wake District Attorney Freeman has declined to comment directly on O'Neill's motion, but said a number of factors contributed to the issues in both Rasmussen and Green. One is making sure that law enforcement officers provide evidence to prosecutors in a timely manner so they can then turn it over to defense attorneys. And last August, she implemented a new policy establishing more specific deadlines. Another issue is that the drug unit has a high volume of criminal cases, said Freeman. Those are complex, and since the pandemic, the unit has been staffed with many younger prosecutors, she said. A prosecutor with more than a decade of experience has now been assigned to the drug unit. She also said legal assistants play a crucial role in helping collect and provide discovery to defense attorneys. For some time, legal assistants in the drug unit were also responsible for processing petitions to return firearms seized in criminal cases. Freeman says she has since reassigned that responsibility. She believes the charges she has put in place will ensure these issues won't happen again. Willingham isn't satisfied. When she confronted Stewart, she said he didn't seem aware of how serious his actions were. Quote, he showed no understanding of the significance of how my client's right to a fair trial was affected by his misconduct, which would call into question why anyone should continue to employ him as a district attorney, she said. Next, a pair of articles pertinent to Durham. First, from property taxes to school funding, what is in Durham County's budget proposal? On Monday night, Durham County Manager Claudia Hager presented her proposed budget for the 25-26 fiscal year. The recommended county budget totals over $1 billion. That's a 7.4% increase, about $71 million, over last year. Hager said the additional funding prioritizes education, public safety, and personnel compensation. Property tax revenue, the county's main source of revenue, is expected to jump nearly $48 million. That's because in January, new valuations went into effect for Durham County property owners. This year, higher property values and a growing population of taxpayers resulted in an $86 billion, or 60% property value increase across the county compared with the last valuation back in 2019. to offset the spike in property values, the county manager suggested lowering the tax rate from the current rate of 79 cents per $100 to revenue neutral at about 52 cents per $100, before tacking on an additional 3.5%, which would set the county-wide tax rate at 55.4 cents per $100. Essentially, Hager proposes a major cut to the property tax rate next fiscal year, but because property values went up so steeply, owners will not see a proportionate decline in their bills. With the proposed tax rate and new values, the average tax bill for 2025 would amount to just $2,300, up from $1,700 in 2019. While the overall budget increased, some key revenue sources are expected to remain neutral or drop in the coming year. For example, sales tax revenue skyrocketed from 2021 to 24 after the lockdown was lifted for COVID, growing by a staggering $22 million in 23-24, compared to an average of $4.5 million in the 5 years before the pandemic. But last year, the growth in sales tax slowed with only a $3 million increase over the previous year. That downward trend looks to continue. Total sales tax revenue is projected to decrease by over $1 million in the coming fiscal year, totaling about $130 million. Occupancy tax revenue, that's funds generated from fees on hotel stays and short-term rentals, is also projected to decrease by 33% due to changes in state law. Last year, city and county leaders worked with state lawmakers to redirect occupancy tax funds to Discover Durham, that's the local tourism agency, to support the organization's Durham Next initiative. That new nonprofit aims to cultivate the necessary resources from local government and outside investors to take big swings at capital improvement projects like building a new convention center and improving other public amenities, which would help drive up sales and occupancy tax in downtown and across Durham. With sales tax and other revenue expected to decline, the county manager said her staff worked hard to prevent any cuts to current services and provide an increase in funding for priority items whenever possible. Education funding remains one of the county's top priorities and is its largest expenditure. The manager's proposed budget includes more than $223 million for Durham Public Schools. Last year, the school system received a historic $20 million increase in funding. The county manager including a $10.5 million increase for the coming year, falling short of the $16 million increase the school board requested in its meeting. Despite the shortfall, the funding would keep Durham in the top five per pupil spending statewide. Hager said, "While we have made substantial progress with these funds, I'm aware of the remaining funding gaps within the district." Public safety also received a significant investment in the county's proposal. The majority of new full-time employees, FTEs, are for the various departments that make up the public safety system in Durham County. Those same departments also received funding for new equipment and other non-personnel expenses. The Sheriff's Department would receive 5 new officers to support increased coverage in the RTP region, and 43 new vehicles, 38 replacements, and 5 new vehicles for the new hires. EMS would receive 12 additional FTEs to help alleviate staff workload and increase ambulance availability. Durham's Youth Home, a controversial detention center that's entering its third and final phase of expansion, also stands to get 8.5 new FTEs which Hager said would bring the center to 100% operational capacity. Notably missing from the public safety discussion was the expansion of HEART, HART, into the county limits. At the May 5th work session, commissioners received an hour-long presentation from Ryan Smith, the City of Durham's Community Safety Director, on the success of the HART program and its viability countywide. The Sheriff's Office and County Commissioners have expressed varying levels of interest in pursuing expansion, but no meaningful action has been taken. The City of Durham is likely to sign off on further expanding HART's capacity within city limits when it votes on its own budget in June. Creating a balanced budget is even more challenging for local leaders this year. County staff, like their city government colleagues, have to juggle their own fiscal responsibilities while trying to navigate economic pressure and uncertainty at the state and federal level. In the last decade, Durham's population has grown by an estimated 60,000 people, requiring an increasingly robust network of services that includes education, public safety, transportation, public health, and more. And Hager said during the meeting, every year fiscal strength and fiscal stress balance precariously between the competing need for revenue and expenditure growth. But this is not Hager's first rodeo. While it is her first budget presentation since taking office in December, Hager served as the Cudgett County's budget and finance director for 9 years and deputy county manager for 2. Hager, like her city counterpart, Beau Ferguson, who will present his own budget proposal on May 19th, have over a decade of experience and understand how the region has changed in a way that few others do. Hager said, guiding our organization through the current fiscal climate presents a significant challenge. We must make decisions that avoid creating burdens on our residents, and we must make sustainable decisions that provide services regardless of the current environment. Now, on May 27th, Tuesday, residents can sign up to participate in the next budget public hearing Tuesday. Residents can also comment on the proposed budget through a resident budget survey on the county website. The Board of County Commissioners will vote to approve or not the final Durham County budget, a vote coming on Monday, June the 9th. Now, positive development in affordable housing in Durham, particularly on downtown Durham's Main Street. Applications are open for a new affordable housing complex, and they'll start accepting leases next week. It's Renegade, a 110-unit apartment complex built on county-owned land on East Main Street, offers units ranging from studios to 3 bedrooms. Now, notably, 22 of these units are available for folks making up to 30% of the area median income, up to 30% of AMI, which amounts to about $32,000 for a 4-person household. Another 68 are set aside for folks making up to 60%, and 20 units for folks up to 80% AMI. The building also includes a 757-space structured parking deck, a child care center, and additional commercial retail space. LSA Management, a property management company based in Charlotte, is in charge of leasing the apartments. Interested residents can submit pre-applications at a launch event hosted by LSA on May the 15th at Durham Bottling Company. This launch event in this article provides a link to a website, but the link is not typed here, so I can't tell it to you. LSA Management in Charlotte. Would you look them up and also ask about Renegade, the apartment unit system. It's a milestone in an 8-year effort to take advantage of publicly owned land in order to build centrally located and sorely needed affordable housing without the cost of buying prime downtown real estate. In 2017, Durham County approached the UNC School of Government's Development Finance Initiative to provide development consultation for county-owned sites on the 300 and 500 blocks of Main Street. The process involved public engagement, site analysis, planning, and a financial feasibility study. The county entered into a development agreement with Laurel Street Residential, a development firm closely linked to LSA, and ZOM Living in 2021. Next week, everyone who was involved in supporting the construction of these vital affordable housing units can breathe a sigh of relief. Durham County Board of Commissioners Chair Nita Alam says, "It's gone across three boards to bring this project to fruition, so I'm excited. I'm glad we're at the finish line because construction costs are going up. Property costs have skyrocketed in the last decade, and the cost of building materials has been impacted by COVID, global wars, and more recently, economic instability due to tariffs. Most of the new market-rate apartments constructed in the past several years were built on private land and do not include any affordability stipulations. Public-private partnerships on publicly owned land present a rare occasion where local governments have leverage to bake affordability into a project, as long as the political will exists. Willard Street Apartments, an affordable housing complex near the downtown Durham Transit Station that opened in 2021, was a joint partnership between a mix of private developers and the city of Durham, who ponied up the land for the projects. Of its 82 total units, 21 were available at the 30% AMI threshold. Alam said, "It's expensive to do it downtown. The only way we were able to do this is because the county put in the funding and used our own land." Durham County retained ownership of the land on the 300 block of Main Street, and Laurel Street Residential has a ground lease in perpetuity for both the 300 and 500 affordable housing sites. At the joint City Council Planning Committee meeting Tuesday, local leaders discussed creating what Alam calls a land bank. That would be a consolidated list of all the properties owned by the city, county, and Durham Public Schools, which would allow the three entities to better identify what land could be available for future affordable housing projects, especially land that falls along that transit opportunity area's locations, primed for what Commissioner Wendy Jacobs described in that meeting as a high-density, mixed-use, compact, walkable, bikeable, transit-oriented development. Jacob said during that meeting, "We do have a lot of publicly owned land, and I'm not sure that's really being focused on enough. But honestly, if we come up with these incredible, mixed-use, dense neighborhoods, and only a certain economic group can afford to live in them, we will not have achieved our goals in our community." City Council is approving new housing at nearly every council meeting these days, much to the chagrin of some residents. But housing supply still lags behind demand in Durham. Without building on public land or utilizing tax credits, access to affordable housing, especially at that 30% AMI level, will be difficult to come by for residents who most need it. Tanisha Bullock, regional manager at LSA, says the firm plans to do a lot of outreach in the coming months to ensure that the folks who qualify for the affordable units know about them and have the resources to apply. She said, "We're marketing to the housing authorities, working with NC Housing Finance Agency and their key rent assistance program, and taking vouchers from other sources as well. We're going to be doing a lot of marketing, catching foot traffic, passing out flyers, trying to get into areas where perhaps those people are working and letting them know we're here. Laurel Street Residential and ZOM Living, a market-rate developer based in Florida, oversaw construction of the Renegade and its sister development on county-owned land at the 500 block of East Main Street. That project includes the Maison, M-A-I-Z-O-N, a 248-unit market-rate complex and an additional 195-unit mixed-income building, which is set to begin construction this summer. Laurel Street also worked on The Joyce, a senior housing community on Moorhead Avenue, and The Vanguard in East Durham near Golden Belt. The Renegade apartment building still needs a few finishing touches, so no tours of the apartments will be available at the leasing event. But the company website does include floor plans and a few photos of the units. Residents will have access to an on-site playground, a fitness center, and a laundry room for units without a washer-dryer hookup. And the complex is also in the heart of downtown, where residents will have access to important services like transportation and health care. Renegade is near a bus stop, the county's public health building, the downtown library, and other municipal facilities. More residents downtown could also support the growing number of businesses in that area of East Main Street, like Missy Lane's. Future residents fortunate enough to get a spot at the Renegade will have downtown Durham at their fingertips. And Bullock said, "The location is everything. The views are amazing. I want to move into one of the units myself." Oh, an extreme year. Scientists weigh in on North Carolina's pollen bloom. Wonder if any of you folks have noticed this pollen bloom. Well, when Raleigh native Ben Schiffman went to dinner with his girlfriend in Carrboro, a thick layer of yellow pollen coated the table and silverware. A lifelong sufferer of pollen allergies, Schiffman began to have trouble breathing. He made it through dinner with the help of an inhaler, but during a post-meal walk, he became nauseous. "I hope I don't yak," he said, handing a box of leftovers to his girlfriend. Moments later, he ducked into an alleyway to throw up, an allergic reaction he'd never had before. He said his allergies have been particularly bad this year, with a noticeable difference between North Carolina and other states. He said, "I travel quite a lot to South Carolina and Georgia, and the pollen in North Carolina was so insane. Coming back to Raleigh, my parents' house is just covered head to toe with yellow pollen. I can't wait for the season to be over." For several days in March, yellow pollen clung to seemingly every outdoor surface, sidewalks, cars, benches. While that initial blast is gone from view, washed away by rain, pollen season is far from done, and the factors that potentially caused this boom, warmer weather, milder winters, are here to stay. According to a press release from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about a fourth of adults in the U.S. have seasonal allergies. Dr. Edwin Kim, chief of UNC Pediatric Allergy and Immunology, said, "Allergies are an overreaction from our immune system, which is designed to fight off foreign material like bacteria and viruses." But Kim said, "But for people who are allergic, their immune system sees things like pollen that should be otherwise perfectly safe and benign, thinks they're bad, and develops antibodies specifically against it. These float around in our bloodstreams, waiting for exposure to pollen before releasing chemicals like histamine, which cause those symptoms associated with allergies, congestion, runny nose, itchy eyes, coughing, wheezing, and more." Greg Copenhaver, a UNC Chapel Hill biology professor who researches plant genetics, says it's the proteins on the outside of the pollen molecules that people are allergic to. These proteins are essential for fertilization, telling the plants to accept the pollen that lands on them. It just happens because the proteins are so abundant in an airborne way, we become sensitized to them and they become allergenic. all of the yellow pollen outside, which comes from pine trees, isn't actually that allergenic due to the larger size of molecules and the smaller number of proteins. Copenhaver said of pine pollen, they're kind of cute when you look at them under a microscope. They look like Mickey Mouse. They got a round part and then two ear-like structures on them. Fellow UNC Chapel Hill professor and paleobotanist Patricia Gensel's description is more direct. Each pollen molecule has a central body and two small bladders. Pine pollen is a couple of hundred micrometers large, compared to the more allergenic oak pollen, which is 50 micrometers and has more proteins. Oak pollen's smaller size allows it to infiltrate the body better, and its increased protein count, its flowers are pickier about which pollen to accept, induces stronger reaction. Sean Taylor, a public information officer from the NC Division of Air Quality, wrote in a statement to UNC Media Hub, "It's difficult to define a start or end to pollen season because activity depends on varying factors, plant species, weather, geography. But generally, spring is when trees pollinate, first junipers and cedars, then oaks, pines, and maples. In the summer, tree pollen decreases, replaced in prominence by grass pollen. That's considered the most allergenic, then by weed pollen in the fall. People can be allergic to some pollen types and not others. That weed pollen stays until the year's first hard frost, when the temperature dips below 28 degrees for at least a few hours. Tree pollen season begins when the weather warms again. However, as temperatures in North Carolina stay warmer for longer, pollen season has both started earlier and ended later than it did in past decades." Kim said, "For someone with a classic seasonal pollen allergy, you used to get a little bit of relief for 2 or 3 months in the wintertime. Now we're lucky to have 1 month with no pollen." In addition to being longer, Copenhaver said pollen seasons are getting more intense. He said multiple factors can influence the creation and dispersal of pollen. For example, a hard downpour will knock pollen out of the air, but light sprinkles over a longer period can encourage pollen production as plants utilize the moisture to pollinate. Also, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere aids plant photosynthesis, allowing them to produce more flowers, which produce more pollen. Gensel and fellow professor Robert Peet, who specializes in plant ecology, agreed with a general observation that there was a lot of visible pollen this March. Peet said, "It's an extreme year. We haven't experienced anything quite this extreme in the nearly 50 years we've lived here." Peter White, another professor at UNC who researches plant ecology, wrote in an email that while warmer temperatures could speed up developmental processes, thus shortening pollen's dispersal period, increased pollen density during a particular time, like those yellow-tinted weeks in March, doesn't necessarily mean the total amount of pollen in the season has grown. Gensel also said the pollination process was condensed this year. The latter months of 2024 were mild. Then North Carolina had a burst of cold, that snow in January and February, followed by a quick warming. She said this made plants shed their pollen at the same time instead of during a spread-out period. "We went from sort of feeling nothing to all of a sudden it's all coming out at once. It was a double whammy that really knocked people over." She said the mild winter with lots of decomposition, more nutrients in the soil for trees to soak up, could have stimulated a mast year, M-A-S-T, a mechanism among certain trees to avoid having all their seeds destroyed by overproducing them in 1 year, with following years seeing very little seed production. "But what if we continue to see these milder, shorter winters?" Peet said there could be a climate change thing here where this may become more frequent because the trees have not evolved in the context of the warmer environment. So behaving differently than in their normal situation. And there's a little more to this article, which I will just shorten by stopping to read it, because it's going to make me sneeze any second. Now, you listeners may recall that Indie Week has started a regular weekly column called Lunch Money, where one of their writers visits a local establishment with a cap made on money spent to find how to find a healthful, good-tasting meal for a certain low cost. I forget what the rule is. I think it's maybe $12, $13, $15 to spend on lunch. And they go to a different place each week. Lena Geller went to the Shanghai, 34 Hillsborough Road, Durham, and writes this article. When I step into Shanghai, Durham's oldest operating Chinese restaurant, the hostess beckons me towards her stand. See that booth? She said, go, and I will follow. I head to the booth, tucked in a back corner next to a bookshelf, stocked with wine bottles and silk foliage, and slide in. And here is her receipt. Lunch special, $9.50. Tax, 75 cents. Tip, $2.05. Her total spent for this meal, $12.30. And she goes on, Shanghai has been holding court in a strip mall on Hillsborough Road, nestled between Cricket Wireless and a Five Below, since the late 1980s. With no windows in the dining area, time feels suspended, like I've entered a pocket dimension where the outside world ceases to exist. At 12:30 on Friday, the restaurant is half full. Three men engage in conversation at one table, Duke students another. Couple at the booth is chatting animatedly in Spanish. Several solo diners occupy booths throughout the space, poking at their phones with one hand while eating noodles and stir-fried veggies with the other. The hostess is a whirlwind of efficiency, dropping items at several tables before materializing at mine. When she sets down my menu, the table wobbles slightly. She frowns. Is the table moving, or is it just me? She places her palms on the surface and presses down hard. The table jolts. She signals me to wait and returns second later with a tiny black square. She slides under one leg. 1, 2, 3, she counts. Still moving? Nope. Another server brings over the hot tea. I came here because of the lunch special. It's remarkably budget-friendly at $9.50, including entree, rice, and your choice of a pork egg roll or soup, hot and sour wonton or egg drop. I ate at Shanghai a lot growing up in Durham. It was usually takeout, and my parents always handled the ordering, selecting multiple dishes for our family to share. As an adult, facing my own menu in the actual restaurant, there's something almost transgressive about selecting just one dish for myself. There are more than 20 entree options. Beef with green peppers, nutsi chicken, mugugai pan, and so on. Needing a strategy? I remember reading in an old News and Observer review of the restaurant that chef specializes in Cantonese cuisine. So I ask the server, which of the entrees are Cantonese? Just the chicken, she says. I order it with wonton soup and fried rice. The soup arrives with a bowl of addictive, crunchy wonton strips. It tastes like childhood. When the main course follows, I'm confronted with what appears to be enough food for two people. The chicken's fried golden brown, sliced into thick pieces, blanketed in a jelly-like sauce. Beneath and around is a garden's worth of vegetables, snap peas, zucchini, cauliflower, onion, summer squash, broccoli, mushrooms, and carrots. The veggies tucked under the chicken stay piping hot throughout the meal. When I bite into the chicken, it offers a loud, theatrical crunch that would be spelled with five R's in a comic book. Crunch! The fried rice isn't revelatory, but it provides a welcome, salty component to the main attraction. As I snap some photos, the hostess returns, offering to hold my plate at a slant for better lighting. In this windowless space, her impromptu food photography assistance feels both amusing and oddly touching. When the check arrives with a fortune cookie, I'm pleased to see my total comes to $10.25 with tax. I add a 20% tip, well under budget at $12.30. unlike my previous column, where my tip option panic pushed me over. With that out of the way, I crack open the fortune cookie. Doors will open for you in many areas of your life. If one of those doors leads to a gem like Shanghai, I'll consider myself fortunate indeed. Well, probably my final article from this week's Indie Week, littler pocket-sized East Paris bistro of almost a decade is to close. The downtown Durham restaurant that emulated the cozy feel of an intimate dinner party or New York bistro tucked into a side street will close June the 21st. It marks the end of a 9-year run for Littler, which opened up back on East Paris Street in 2016. It's also the second closure in 2 years for the owner, Gray Brooks, who shuttered his modern diner concept, Jack Tar and the Colonel's Daughter, in 2023. His popular wood-fired pizza restaurant, Pizzeria Toro, remains open. While Brooks attributed Jack Tar's closure to diminished downtown foot traffic past COVID, post-COVID, he sees Littler challenges as more structural. Its exceptionally small size, with just 36 seats, made financial viability an ongoing struggle. He said the numbers worked when we didn't have a sous chef, but that just really put an inhumane burden on the chef. When we did have one and were able to provide normal, good jobs for our staff, the financial burden on the restaurant was just too much. COVID could have played a role in the way I didn't realize at the time. Littler closed the first 2 years of the pandemic and permanently shortened its hours, closing an hour earlier each night than it had before the pandemic. It kind of bled us out. Looking ahead, he plans to focus his energy on bolstering Pizzeria Toro. He's recently acquired a mobile oven for catering and has developed a Toro-style version of New York pizza. That's the upside, he says, hopefully. Now I'll have a little more time to work on that. Well, the music tells me it's time to close this issue of Indie Week. You can find Indie Week online at indieweek.com, indieweek.com, and read all these stories and more and past issues as well. While John Feddersen has enjoyed rushing through what I could get at today, I'll be back next week from the North Carolina Reading Service with another weekly edition of the Independent Indie Week. Thank you for listening, everybody. Farewell.